12 Duncan Fife dining chairs? To Dallas? He said, sipping at his champagne. All that important Sheraton to the buyer in Houston? And a great deal more of same in Los Angeles? I tried not to let my expression waver. Museum quality pieces. Of course, including Mrs. Barber in this. We all know, don't we, that museum quality really depends on the sort of museum you're talking about. Ha ha. But Lucius has really done a very good job of following some of your more enterprising sales of late. And, once the holidays are over, he's been thinking of taking a trip down to Texas to... Ah, he said, turning from me with a deft little dance-like step as Kitsy, in ice-blue satin, swept in to greet us. A welcome and ornamental addition indeed. You look lovely, my dear, he said, leaning to kiss her. I've just been talking to your charming husband-to-be. Really quite shocking. The friends in common we have. Oh? It was not until she actually turned to me, to look at me full on, to peck me on the cheek, that I realized Kitsy hadn't been 100% sure that I would show up. Her relief at the sight of me was palpable.
And are you giving Theo and Mommy all the scandal? She said, turning back to Havistock.
Oh, kitty cat, you are wicked. Cozily, he slipped his arm through hers and, with the other, reached over and patted her on the hand. A little Puritan-looking devil of a man, thin, amiable, spry. Now, my dear, I see you are in need of a drink, as am I. Let's wander off on our own, shall we? Another glance back at me. And find a nice quiet spot, so we can have a good long gossip about your fiancé.
32.
Thank heavens he's gone,
murmured Mrs. Barber after they had wandered away to the drinks table.
Small chatter tires me terribly.
Same here. The sweat was pouring off me. How had he found out? All the pieces he'd mentioned I'd shipped through the same carrier. Still, I was desperate for a drink.
How could he know?
Mrs. Barber, I was aware, had just spoken.
Excuse me? I said, isn't this extraordinary? I'm astonished by this great mob of people.
She was dressed very simply. Black dress, black heels, and the magnificent snowflake brooch. But black was not Mrs. Barber's color, and it only gave her a renunciate look of illness and mourning.
Must I mingle? I suppose I must. Oh, God, look, there's Anne's husband. What a bore. Is it very awful of me to say that I wish I was at home?
Who was that man just now? I asked her.
Havistock?
She passed her hand over her forehead.
I'm glad he is so insistent about his name, or I would have had a hard time introducing you.
I would have thought he was a dear friend of yours. Unhappily, she blinked, with a discomposure that made me feel guilty for the tone I'd taken with her.
Well, she said resolutely, he is very familiar. That is to say, he has a very familiar manner. He is that way with everyone. How do you know him? Oh, Havistock does volunteer work for the New York Historical Society. Knows everything and everyone. Although, just between us, I don't think he's a descendant of Washington Irving at all.
No?
Well, he's altogether charming. That is to say, he knows absolutely everyone. Claims an Astor connection, as well as the Washington Irving one. And who's to say he is wrong? Some of us have found it interesting that many of the connections he invokes are dead. That said, Havistock's delightful, or can be. Very, very good about visiting the old ladies. Well, you heard him just now. Perfect trove of information about New York history. Dates, names, genealogies. Before you came up, he was filling me in on the history of every single building up and down the street. All the old scandals. Society murder in the townhouse next door, 1870s. He knows absolutely everything. That said, at a luncheon a few months ago, he was regaling the table with an utterly scurrilous story about Fred Astaire, which I don't feel can possibly be true. Fred Astaire, cursing like a sailor, throwing a fit. Well, I don't mind telling you that I simply didn't believe it. None of us did. Chance's grandmother knew Fred Astaire back when she was working in Hollywood, and she said he was simply the loveliest man alive. Never heard a whisper to the contrary. Some of the old stars were perfectly horrible, of course, and we've heard all those stories, too. Oh, she said despairingly in the same breath, how tired and hungry I feel.
Here, feeling sorry for her, leading her to an empty chair, sit down. Would you like me to get you something to eat?
No, please. I'd like you to stay with me. Although I suppose I shouldn't hog you to myself, she said unconvincingly. Guest of honor.
Honestly, it won't take a minute. My eyes sped round the room. Trays of hors d'oeuvres were going around and there was a table with food in the next room, but I urgently needed to talk to Hobie. I'll be back as fast as I can. Luckily, Hobie was so tall, taller than virtually everyone else, that I had no difficulty spotting him, a lighthouse of safety in the crowd. Hey, said someone, catching my arm as I was almost to him. It was Platt, in a green velvet jacket that smelled like mothballs, looking rumpled and anxious and already half-sloshed.
Everything okay between you two?
What?
You and Kitz get everything hashed out?
I wasn't entirely sure how to answer this. After a few moments of silence, he pushed a string of gray blonde hair behind one ear. His face was pink and swollen with premature middle age, and I thought, not for the first time, how there'd been no freedom for Platt in his refusal to grow up, how by slacking off too long, he'd managed to destroy every last glimmer of his hereditary privilege. And now, he was always going to be loitering at the margins of the party, with his gin and lime, while his baby brother Toddy, still in college, stood talking in a group which included the president of an Ivy League college, a billionaire financier, and the publisher of an important magazine. Platt was still looking at me.
Listen, he said, I know it's none of my business. You and Kitz.
I shrugged.
Tom doesn't love her, he said impulsively. It was the best thing that ever happened to Kitsy when you came along, and she knows it. I mean, the way he treats her. She was with him, you know, that weekend Andy died. That was the big important reason why she sent Andy up to look after Daddy, even though Andy was hopeless with Daddy. Why she didn't go herself. Tom, Tom, Tom. All about Tom. And yeah, apparently he's all endless love with her, my only love, or so she says. But believe me, it's a different story behind her back. Because, he paused in frustration, the way he strung her along, leached money constantly, went around with other girls and lied about it. It made me sick. Mommy and Daddy, too. Because, basically, she's a meal ticket to him. That's how he sees her. But, don't ask me why. She was crazy for him. Completely off her head.
Still is, it seems.
Platt made a face. Oh, come on. It's you she's marrying.
Cable doesn't strike me as the marrying type.
Well, he took a big slug of his drink. Whoever Tom does marry, I feel sorry for them. Kitz may be impulsive, but she's not stupid.
Nope. Kitsy was far from stupid. Not only had she arranged for the marriage that would most please her mother, she was sleeping with the person she really loved.
It would never have panned out. Like Mommy said, utter infatuation, a rope of sand.
She told me she loved him.
Well, girls always love assholes,
said Platt, not bothering to dispute this.
Haven't you noticed?
No, I thought bleakly. Untrue. Else, why didn't Pippa love me?
Say, you need a drink, pal. Actually,
knocking the rest of his back,
I could use another myself.
Look, I just have to go and speak to someone. Also, your mother. I turned and pointed off in the direction where I'd seated her. She needs a drink, too, and something to eat.
Mommy,
said Platt, looking like I'd just reminded him of a kettle he'd left boiling on the stove, and hurried off. 33.
Hobie?
He seemed startled at the touch of my hand on his sleeve, turned quickly.
Everything all right?
He said immediately. I felt better just standing next to him,
just to breathe in the clean air of Hobie. Listen, I said, glancing round nervously. If we could just have a quick...
Ah, and is this the groom?
Interjected a woman in his eagerly hovering group.
Yes, congratulations.
More strangers pressing forward.
How young he looks. How very young you look.
Blonde lady, mid-50s, pressing my hand.
And how handsome.
Turning to her friend.
Prince Charming. Can he be a moment over 22?
Courteously, Hobie introduced me around the circle. Gentle, tactful, unhurried, a social lion of the mildest sort. I said, looking around the room. Sorry to drag you away, Hobie. I hope you won't think me rude if...
Word in private? Certainly. You'll excuse me?
Hobie, I said, as soon as we were in a relatively quiet corner. The hair at my temples was damp with sweat. Do you know a man named Havistock Irving? The pale brows came down.
Who?
He said, and then, looking at me more closely,
Are you sure you're all right?
His tone and his expression made me realize that he knew more about my mental state than he'd been letting on.
Sure,
I said, pushing my glasses up on the bridge of my nose.
I'm fine. But listen,
Havistock Irving, does that name ring a bell?
No. Should it?
Somewhat erratically, I was dying for a drink. It had been foolish of me not to stop at the bar on the way over. I explained. As I spoke, Hobie's face grew blanker and blanker.
What? He said, scanning over the heads of the crowd. Do you see him?
Throngs milling by the buffet, beds of cracked ice, gloved servers shucking oysters by the bucketful.
There!
Hobie, short-sighted without his glasses, blinked twice and squinted.
What?
He said shortly.
Him with the...
He brought his hands up to the sides of his head to simulate the two puffs of hair.
Yes, that's him.
Well,
he folded his arms with a rough, unpracticed ease that made me see for a flash the alternate Hobie. Not the tailor-fitted antiquaire, but the cop or tough priest he might have been in his old Albany life.
You know him? Who is he?
Ah.
Hobie, uncomfortably, patted his breast pocket for a cigarette he wasn't allowed to smoke.
Do you know him?
I repeated more urgently, unable to stop myself glancing over at the bar in Havistock's direction. Sometimes it was hard to get information out of Hobie on touchy matters. He tended to change the subject, clam up, drift into vagueness, and the worst possible place to ask him anything was a crowded room where some genial party was apt to wander up and interrupt.
Wouldn't say no. We've had dealings. What's he doing here?
Friend of the bride, I said, and received a startled look at the tone in which I'd said this.
How do you know him?
Rapidly he blinked.
Well,
he said somewhat reluctantly,
don't know his real name. Welty and I knew him as Sloane Griscom. But his true name, something else entire.
Who is he?
Knocker,
said Hobie curtly. Right, I said, after an off-balance pause. A knocker, in the trade, was a shark who charmed his way into old people's homes to cheat them of valuables and sometimes to rob them outright. Hobie rocked on his heels, looked awkwardly away.
Rich pickings for him here, that's for sure. First-class swizzler. Him and his partner as well. Smart as Satan, those two.
A radiantly smiling bald man in a clerical collar was threading his way toward us. I folded my arms and tried to angle myself away from him, blocking his approach, hoping Hobie wouldn't see and cut his story short to welcome him.
Lucian Race. At least, that was the name he went by. Oh, they were a pretty pair. See, Havistock, or Sloane, or whatever he's calling himself now, would chat up the old ladies, and old gents, too, get to know where they lived, drop in to visit. He'd hunt them out at benefit dinners, funerals, important Americana auctions, all over the place. Anyway,
studying his drink,
he'd turn up to visit with his delightful friend, Mr. Race, and while the old dears were occupied, really it was dreadful, jewelry, paintings, watches, silver, whatever they could lay their hands on. Well, he said on an altered note, long time ago.
I wanted a drink myself so badly it was difficult for me not to keep glancing in the direction of the bar. Already I could see Toddie pointing me out to an elderly couple who were smiling expectantly in my direction, like they were about to dodder over and introduce themselves, and obstinately I turned my back.
Old folks? I repeated to Hobie, hoping to get a little more out of him.
Yes, sorry to say it, but they preyed on some pretty helpless people. Anyone that let them in the door.
And a lot of the old folks didn't have much. They'd clean them out in one go, but if there was real loot for the taking,
oh, they'd keep up the fruit baskets and the confidential talks and the hand-patting for weeks.
The priest, or minister, or whoever he was, had seen that I was engaged and had held up a friendly hand. Later, as he edged past in the crowd, and I threw him a grateful smile.
Was he the Episcopal bishop, Father what's-his-name, who was supposed to be marrying us?
Or one of the Catholic priests from St. Ignatius that Mrs. Barber had taken up with after Andy and Mr. Barber had died?
Very, very smooth. Sometimes they'd pretend to be furniture appraisers, offering free valuations. That's how they'd get the foot in. Or, with the really dire cases, bedridden, daffy, they'd con the home health nurses, pretend to be family. Still and all, Hobie shook his head. Have you had anything to eat? He asked in his changing the subject voice. Yeah, I said, though I hadn't. Thanks, but say. Oh, good, with relief. There's oysters over there, and caviar. The crab thing was good, too. You never came up for lunch today. I left a plate of beef stew for you, some green beans and salad. You didn't eat it. I saw it was still in the fridge.
What did you and Welty have to do with him?
Hobie blinked.
Sorry,
he said in his distracted way.
Oh,
nodding his head in Griscom's direction.
Him?
Right. The holiday brightness of the room, lights, mirrors, fireplaces ablaze and chandeliers glittering, had given me a nightmarish feeling of being pressed in upon and observed from all sides.
Well,
he looked away. They just brought out a fresh bowl of caviar. He was already half-turned toward the buffet, and then relented.
He turned up in the shop with a load of jewelry and silver to sell. Years back now, didn't he? Family stuff, he claimed. Only one salt cellar. It was early, important, and Welty knew it because he knew the lady he'd sold it to. And he knew she'd been swizzled by a pair of knocker boys who'd conned their way in pretending to collect old books for charity. Anyhow, Welty took the pieces on consignment and called the old lady and called the police. And me, well, on my end,
blotting his forehead with the flowered Liberty Square from his pocket. His voice was so quiet I could barely hear him, but I didn't dare ask him to speak up.
18 months earlier, I'd bought an estate from the guy. I should have known something was wrong, but nothing I could put my finger on, not quite. Brand new building in the East 80s. Odd collection of Americana, piled harum-scarum in the middle of the room. Tea chests, banjo clocks, whalebone figurines, Windsor chairs enough to start a school with. But no rugs, no sofa, nothing to eat from, no place to sleep. Well, I'm sure you would have had it figured before me. No estate, no auntie. Just a flat he'd rented on the fly to warehouse his ill-gotten gains. And the thing was, too, and this is what threw me, I knew him by reputation, because at the time he had his own little shop, just a storefront, real little bandbox, actually, on Madison, not far from the old Park Burnett. Very pretty place, appointment only. Chevalier Antiques. Some really first-rate French stuff. Not my bailiwick. Every time I ever went by there, it was closed. Always used to look in the window. Never knew who owned it, until he contacted me about this estate. And?
I said, turning my back yet again, telepathically willing Platt to stay away from me with the head of his publishing house, whom he was triumphantly leading over to meet me.
And, he sighed, long story short, it went to court, and Welty and I gave statements. Sloane, the dilapidateur, as Welty called him, had vanished into thin air by that time. Shop cleared out overnight. Renovation. Never opened again, of course. But Race, I believe, went to jail.
When was this? Hobie bit the side of his forefinger and thought,
oh, goodness, has to be 30 years ago? 35, even?
And Race?
His brow came down.
Is he here?
Scanning the crowd again.
Not that I've seen. Hair like this.
Hobie measured it with a fingertip, down below the nape of his neck.
Over the collar, like the English wear it.
English of a certain age.
White hair?
Not then. Maybe now. And little, mean mouth.
He puckered up his lips.
Like so.
That's him.
Well.
He fished in his pocket for his magnifying light, before seeming to realize that the occasion didn't require it.
You offered him his money back. So if it really is Race, I don't understand why he's pressing. Because he's absolutely in no position to cause trouble or make demands, is he?
No,
I said, after a long pause, though this was such a big lie that I could hardly force the word out of my mouth.
Well then, don't look so worried,
said Hobie, clearly relieved to be off the subject.
This is absolutely the last thing that should spoil your evening. Although,
clapping me on the shoulder, he was looking across the room for Mrs. Barber,
you should certainly warn Samantha.
She shouldn't be letting that scoundrel in her house, for any reason whatsoever.
Hello,
he said, turning to find the elderly couple, who had finally managed to dodder over and were smiling expectantly behind us.
James Hobart, may I introduce you to the groom?
34. The party was from 6 to 9. I smiled, sweated, tried to make my way to the bar only to get waylaid and cut off and sometimes physically dragged back by the arm like Tantalus, dying of thirst while in very sight of relief.
And here he is, man of the hour.
The Beamish boy. Congratulations.
Here, Theodore, you must meet Harry's cousin Francis. The Longstreets and the Abernathys are related on the father's side. Boston branch of the family. Chance's grandfather, you see, was the first cousin of...
Francis? Oh, you two know each other?
Perfect.
And here is... Oh, Elizabeth, there you are. Let me steal you away for a moment.
Don't you look delightful? That blue suits you beautifully. I'd very much like to introduce you to...
At last, I gave up on the idea of drink and food and, hemmed in amongst the ever-shifting press of strangers, stood snatching flutes of champagne from the waiters who happened by. Every now and then an hors d'oeuvre, tiny quiche Lorraine, miniature blini with caviar, strangers coming and going, locked in and nodding politely amidst the crowds of well-born, wealthy, powerful.
Never forget you aren't one of them,
my junkie pal from accounts had whispered in my ear when he'd seen me socializing among important clients at an impressionist and modern art sale. Freezing and turning to smile with random groups when the photographer swept in on us, captive to ambient scraps of mind-numbing conversation about golf games, politics, children's sports, children's schools, third and fourth and fifth homes in Hyères and Hyannis and Paris and London and Jackson Hole and Jupiter. And wasn't it hideous how terribly built up Vale had become? Remember when it was just a darling little village?
Where do you ski, Theo?
Do you ski? Why then, definitely you and Kitsy must come out with us to our house in the...
Though I had an eye out for Hobie and Pippa, I scarcely saw them. Playfully, Kitsy dragged people over to introduce me and then vanished as quickly as a bird flying from a windowsill. Havistock, thankfully, was nowhere in evidence. At last, things began to clear out.
but not much. People had started moving toward the coat check, and the waiters were starting to remove the cake and the dessert dishes from the buffet when, trapped in conversation with a group of Kitsy's cousins, I glanced across the room for Pippa, as I had been doing compulsively all night long, trying to catch sight of her red head, the only interesting or important thing in the room. And much to my surprise, espied her with Boris, conversing with animation. He was all over her, loosely draped arm, unlit cigarette dangling from his fingers, whispering, laughing. Was he biting her ear? "Excuse me," I said, and made my way quickly across the room to them by the fireplace, where in perfect unison they turned and held their arms out to me.
"Hello," said Pippa. "We were just talking about you."
"Potter," said Boris,
throwing his arm around me. Though he was dressed for the occasion, in a blue chalk-striped suit, it had often struck me the hordes of rich Russians in the Ralph Lauren shop on Madison. There was somehow no cleaning him up. His smudged eyes made him look stormy and disreputable, and though his hair wasn't technically dirty, it gave the effect of dirtiness.
"I'm happy to see you."
"Same here." I'd asked Boris, never dreaming he would show. It not being in the nature of Boris to remember pesky things like dates or addresses or to turn up on time if he did.
"You know who this is, don't you?"
I said, turning to Pippa.
"Of course she knows me, knows all about me. We are now dearest of friends. Now,"
to me with mock show of officiousness,
"small word in private. You'll excuse us, please," he said to Pippa.
"More private conversations?"
kicking my shoe playfully with her ballet slipper.
"Don't worry, I will bring him back. Goodbye to you,"
blowing a kiss. Then to me, in my ear, as we walked away,
"She is lovely. God, but I love a redhead."
"So do I, but she's not the one I'm engaged to."
"No?"
He looked surprised.
"But she greeted me by my name."
"Ah,"
he said, looking at me more closely.
"Are you blushing?"
"Yes, you are, Potter," he crowed. "Blushing, like a little girl."
"Shut up,"
I hissed, glancing back for fear she'd heard.
"Not her, then? Not little Red? Too bad, huh?"
He was looking round the room.
"Which one, then?"
I pointed her out.
"There." "Ah, in the sky blue?"
He pinched me affectionately on the arm.
"My God, Potter! Her? Loveliest woman in the room. Divine. A goddess."
Making as if to prostrate himself on the floor.
"No, no."
Grabbing him by the arm, hastily pulling him up.
"An angel. Straight from paradise. Pure as a baby's tear. Much too good for the likes of you."
"Yes, I think that's the general opinion.
Although,"
he reached for my vodka glass and took a big slug before handing it back to me.
"A bit icy to look at, no? I like the warmer ones myself.
She
is a lily, a snowflake. Less frosty and private, I hope."
"You'd be surprised." His eyebrows went up.
"Ah, and she is the one?"
"Yes."
"She admitted it?"
"Yes."
"And so you are not standing with her. You are annoyed."
"More or less."
"Well,"
Boris ran his hand through his hair,
"you must go and speak to her now."
"Why?"
"Because we have to leave."
"Leave? Why?"
"Because I need you to take a walk with me."
"Why?" I said, looking around the room, wishing he hadn't dragged me away from Pippa, desperate to find her again. The candles, the orange gleam of firelight where she'd been standing, made me think of the warmth of the wine bar, as if the light itself might be a passageway back to the night before and the little wooden table where we had sat knee to knee, her face washed with the same orange-tinged light. There had to be some way I could walk across the room and grab her hand and pull her back to that moment. Boris threw the hair out of his eyes.
"Come on," You will feel fantastic when you hear what I have to say, but you will need to go home, get your passport. And there is a question of cash, too.
Over Boris's shoulder, imperturbable faces of strange, cold women. Mrs. Barber in profile, slightly turned to the wall, clutching the hand of the jolly cleric who didn't look quite so jolly anymore.
What? Are you listening to me?
Shaking my arm. The same voice that had pulled me back to Earth many times from fractal glue-sniffing skies, where I lay open-eyed and insensate on the bed, gazing at the impressive blue-white explosions on the ceiling.
Come on! Talk in the car! Let's go! I have a ticket for you!
Go? I looked at him. It was all I heard.
I will explain. Don't look at me like that. Everything is good. No worries. But first off, you must arrange to be gone for a couple of days. 3 days, tops. So,
flicking a hand,
go. Go arrange with Snowflake, and let's get out of here. I can't smoke in here, can I?
He said, looking around.
No one is smoking?
Get out of here. They were the only words anyone had said to me that made sense all night.
Because you must go home immediately.
He was endeavoring to catch my eye in a familiar way.
Get your passport and money. How much cash do you have on hand?
Well, in the bank, I said, pushing my glasses up on the bridge of my nose, oddly sobered by his tone.
I am not talking about the bank or tomorrow. I am talking about on hand now.
But
I can get it back, I'm telling you. But we can't stand around here any longer. We must go now, right away. Off with you. Go,
he said, with a friendly little kick in the shin. 35.
There you are, darling, said Kitsy, slipping her arm through my elbow and stretching on tiptoe to kiss me on the cheek,
a kiss caught, simultaneously, by the photographers circling her, one from the social pages, the other hired for the evening by Anne.
Isn't this glorious? Are you exhausted? I hope my family hasn't been too overwhelming. Annie, dear.
Extending a hand to Anne DeLarmison. Stiff blonde hair, stiff taffeta dress, wrinkled neckline that did not match the tautness of her chiseled face.
Listen, it's been absolute heaven. Do you suppose we can get a family snap? Just you, me, and Theo? We three?
Listen, I said impatiently as soon as our awkward photo op was over, and Anne DeLarmison, who clearly didn't consider me anything even approaching family, had drifted away to say goodbye to some other, more important guests.
I'm going.
But,
she looked confused.
I think Anne's booked a table somewhere.
Well, you'll have to make an excuse for me. That shouldn't be a problem for you, should it?
Theo, please don't be hateful.
Because your mother isn't going, I'm sure of it. It was almost impossible to get Mrs. Barber to go out to a restaurant for dinner, unless it was some place she felt sure she wouldn't run into someone she knew.
Say I've taken her home. Say she's been taken ill. Say I've been taken ill.
Use your imagination. You'll think of something.
Are you vexed with me?
Family language. Vexed. A word Andy had used when we were children.
Vexed?
No. Now that it had settled, and I was used to the idea, Cable? Kitsy? It was almost like some scurrilous bit of gossip that had nothing to do with me. She was wearing my mother's earrings, I noticed, which was weirdly moving since she was absolutely right. They didn't suit her at all, and with a pang I reached out and touched them, and then her, on the cheek.
Ah,
cried some onlookers in the background, pleased to finally see some affection between the happy couple. Kitsy, catching to it instantly, seized my hand and kissed it, prompting another battery of snaps.
All right, I said in her ear as she leaned close. If anyone asks, I'm away on business. Old ladies called me to look at an estate.
Certainly. You had to hand it to her. She was cool as damn it.
When will you be back?
Oh, soon, I said, not very convincingly. I would have been happy to walk out of that room and keep walking for days and months until I was on some beach in Mexico, maybe, some isolated shore where I could wander alone and wear the same clothes till they rotted off me, and be the crazy gringo in the horn-rimmed glasses who repaired chairs and tables for a living. Look after yourself, and keep this Havistock out of your mother's house.
Well,
her voice so low I could scarcely hear her.
He's been rather a pest recently. Phones constantly, wanting to drop in, bring flowers, chocolates. Poor old thing. Mum won't see him. Feel a bit guilty about putting him off.
Well, don't. Keep him away. He's a sharper. Now bye,
I said loudly, smacking her on the cheek. More clicking of cameras. This was the shot the photographers had been waiting for all evening. And went to tell Hobie, happily inspecting a portrait, leaning forward with his nose inches from the canvas, that I was leaving for a bit.
Okay,
he said cautiously, turning away. The whole time I'd worked with him, I'd scarcely taken a vacation, certainly never to go out of town.
You and...
He nodded at Kitsy.
No. Everything all right?
Sure. He looked at me. He looked across the room at Boris.
You know, if you need anything, he said unexpectedly, you can always ask.
Right. Yes,
I said, taken aback, not quite sure what he meant or how to respond.
Thanks.
He shrugged, in seeming embarrassment, and turned self-consciously back to the portrait. Boris was at the bar drinking a glass of champagne and gobbling leftover blinis with caviar. Seeing me, he drained the rest of his glass and ticked his head at the door.
Let's get out of here.
See you,
I said to Hobie, shaking his hand, which was not something I ordinarily did, and leaving him to stare after me in some perplexity. I wanted to say goodbye to Pippa, but she was nowhere in sight.
Where was she?
The library? The loo? I was determined to catch another glimpse of her, just one more, before I left.
Do you know where she is?
I said to Hobie, after making a quick tour around, but he only shook his head. So I stood anxiously by the coat check for several minutes, waiting for her to return, until finally Boris, mouth full of hors d'oeuvres, grabbed me by the arm and pulled me down the staircase and out the door. Part 5. We have art in order not to die from the truth. Nietzsche. Chapter 11. The Gentleman's Canal. 1. The Lincoln town car was circling the block, but when the driver stopped for us, it was not Gyuri, but a guy I'd never seen, with a haircut that looked like someone had administered it to him in the drunk tank, and piercing, polar blue eyes. Boris introduced us in Russian.
Privet minya zovut Anatoly,
said the guy, extending a hand slurred with indigo crowns and starbursts like the patterns on Ukrainian Easter eggs.
Anatoly,
I said cautiously.
Uchen priyatna?
A stream of Russian followed, of which I understood not a word, and I turned to Boris in despair.
Anatoly, Boris said pleasantly, does not speak one stitch of English. Do you, Tolly?
In answer, Anatolia gazed at us seriously in the rearview mirror and made another speech. His knuckle tattoos, I was pretty sure, had jailhouse significance. Ink smudges indicating time sentenced, time served, time marked in accretions like rings on a tree.
He says you are pretty speaker, said Boris ironically. Well-schooled in politeness.
Where is Gyuri?
Oh, he flew over yesterday,
Boris said, scrabbling in the breast pocket of his jacket.
Fly?
Fly where?
Antwerp.
My painting's there?
No.
Boris had retrieved two sheets of paper from his pocket, which he scanned in the weak light before passing one to me.
But my flat is in Antwerp, and my car. Gyuri is picking up the car and some things and driving to meet us.
Holding the paper to the light, I saw that it was a printout of an electronic ticket. Confirmed. Decker, Theodore, DL2334. Newark Liberty International to Amsterdam, Netherlands, Boarding time, 12:45 a.m. Total travel time, 7 hours, 44 minutes.
From Antwerp to Amsterdam is only 3 hours drive, said Boris. We will arrive at Schiphol about same time. Me, maybe an hour after you. I had Miriam book us on different planes. Mine connects through Frankfurt. Yours is direct.
Tonight?
Yes. Well, as you see, it does not leave us much time.
And why am I going?
Because I may need some help, and do not want to bring anyone else in on this. Well, Gyuri. But I did not tell even Miriam purpose of our trip. Oh, I could have, he said, interrupting me. It's only fewer people know of this, the better. Anyway, you must run in and get your passport and what cash you can lay hands on. Tolly will drive us to Newark.
He patted the carry-on, which I had only just noticed in the back seat.
I am all ready. We'll wait in the car for you.
And the money?
What do you have?
You should have told me earlier.
No need. The cash.
He was rooting around for a cigarette.
Well, I would not kill yourself with that. Whatever you have, whatever's convenient, because it's not important. It's mostly for show.
I took my glasses off, polished them on my sleeve.
Excuse me?
Because...
Knocking himself with the knuckles on the side of his head, gesture of old, blockhead.
Because I plan to pay them, but not the full amount requested. Reward them for stealing from me? Because why then won't they rob and steal from me whenever they want? What kind of a lesson is this? This man is weak. We can do what we like to him. But,
crossing his legs spasmodically, patting himself down for a light,
I want them to think we are willing to pay the whole thing. Possibly you want to stop at the machine and get money. We can do that on the way, or at the airport, maybe. They will look nice, the new bills.
Offering me a cigarette?
I think you are only allowed to bring 10,000 currency in to EU. But I will rubber band the extra and carry in my case. Also,
offering me a cigarette,
I do not think it is fair for you to come up with the whole sum. I will supply more cash once we get there. My gift to you. And bank draft as well. At any rate, bad paper for bank draft. Bad deposit slip. Bad check. Brass plate bank down in the Caribbean. Looks very good, very legitimate.
I do not know how well that part is going to work out. We will have to play it by ear. No one with any brains is going to accept bank draft instead of cash for something like this. But I think they are inexperienced and desperate, so...
He crossed his fingers.
I am hopeful. We will see.
2. While Anatolia circled the block, I ran into the shop and grabbed all the unbanked cash to hand without counting it, somewhere in the neighborhood of 16,000. Then I ran upstairs and, while Popper paced and circled, whining with anxiety, threw a few things into my bag. Passport, toothbrush, razor, socks, underwear, pair of suit trousers, which were the first thing to hand, couple of extra shirts, sweater. The red breast flake tin was at the bottom of my sock drawer, and I grabbed it up too, and then dropped it and shut the drawer on it, quick. Going into the hall, dog at my heels, Pippa's hunter boots standing outside her bedroom door brought me up sharply. Their bright summer green fused in my mind with her and with happiness. For a moment I paused, uncertain. Then I went back to my room, got the first edition of Ozma of Oz, and dashed a note so quickly I didn't have time to second guess. Safe trip. I love you. No kidding. This I blew dry and tucked in the book, which I lay on the floor by her boots. The resulting tableau on the carpet, Emerald City, green wellies, Ozma's color, was almost as if I'd stumbled on a haiku or some other perfect combination of words to explain to her what she was to me. For a moment I stood in perfect stillness, ticking clock, submerged memories from childhood, doors opening to bright old daydreams where we walked together on summer lawns, before, resolutely, going back to my room for the necklace which had called to me in an auction house showroom with her name. lifting it from its midnight velvet box and, carefully, draping it over one of the boots so a splash of gold caught the light. It was topaz, 18th century, a necklace for a fairy queen, girandole with diamond bow and huge, clear, honey-colored stones, just the shade of her eyes. As I turned away, averting my eyes from the wall of her photos opposite, and hurried down the stairs, it was almost with the old childhood terror and exhilaration of having thrown a rock through a window. Hobie would know exactly how much the necklace had cost. But by the time Pippa found it, and the note, I would be long gone. 3. We were leaving from different terminals, so we said our goodbyes on the curb where Anatolia dropped me. The glass doors slid with a breathless gasp. Inside, past security, on the shiny floors of the pre-dawn concourse, I consulted the monitors and walked past dark shops with the metal gates pulled down. Brookstone, Tie Rack, Nathan's Hot Dogs. Bright 70s music drifting into consciousness. Love, love will keep us together. Think of me, babe, whenever. Past chilly ghost gates that were roped and empty except for college kids sprawled full length and drowsing across four seats at a time. Past the lone bar that was still open, the lone yogurt hut, the lone duty-free where, as Boris had repeatedly and with some urgency advised me to do, I stopped for a fifth of vodka.
Better safe than sorry. Booze only available in the state-controlled shops. Maybe you want to get two.
And then all the way to the end to my own crowded gate, filled with dead-eyed ethnic families, backpackers cross-legged on the floor, and stale, oily-faced businessmen on laptops who looked like they were used to the drill. The plane was full. Shuffling on, crowds in the aisle, economy, middle of the row, five across, I wondered how Miriam had managed to get me a seat at all. Luckily, I was too tired to wonder about much else, and I was asleep almost before the seatbelt light went off, missing drinks, missing dinner, missing the in-flight movies, waking only when the shades were pulled up and light flooded the cabin and the stewardess came pushing her cart through with our pre-packaged breakfasts, chilled twig of grapes, chilled cup of juice, lardy, yolk-yellow cellophane-wrapped croissant, and our choice of coffee or tea. We arranged to meet in baggage claim. Businessmen silently grabbed up their cases and fled to their meetings, their marketing plans, their mistresses, who knew. Loudly shouting stoner kids with rainbow patches on their backpacks jostled each other and tried to snatch duffels that weren't theirs and argued about which was the best wake-and-bake coffee shop to hit in the morning.
Oh, guys, the Bluebird, definitely. No, wait. Harlemmerstraat? No, I'm serious. I wrote it down. It's on this paper. No, wait, listen, guys, we should just go straight there, because I can't remember the name, but it opens early, and they have awesome breakfasts, and you can get your pancakes and OJ and your Apollo 13 and vape up right at the table.
Off they trooped, 15 or 20 of them, carefree, lustrous-haired, laughing, hoisting their backpacks and arguing about the cheapest way to get into town. Despite the fact that I had no checked baggage, I stood in the claim area for well over an hour, watching a heavily taped suitcase circle round and round forlornly on the belt, until Boris came up behind me and greeted me by throwing his arm around my neck in a chokehold and trying to step on the back of my shoes.
"Come on," he said. "You look awful. Let's get something to eat and talk. Guri's got the car outside."
4. What I somehow hadn't expected was a city prinked up for Christmas. Fir boughs and tinsel, starburst ornaments in the shop windows and a cold, stiff wind coming off the canals and fires and festival stalls and people on bicycles, toys and color and candy, holiday confusion and gleam. Little dogs, little children, gossipers and watchers and package bearers, clowns in top hats and military greatcoats, and a little dancing jester in Christmas clothes, a la Avrakamp. I still wasn't quite awake, and none of it seemed to have any more reality than the fleeting dream of Pippa I'd had on the plane, where I'd spotted her in a park with many tall fountains and a Saturn-ringed planet hanging low and majestic in the sky.
Neumarkt,
said Gyuri as we came out on a big circle with a turreted fairy-tale castle and, around it, an open-air market, cut evergreens lightly frosted with snow, mittened vendors stamping, an illustration from a children's book.
Ho, ho, ho.
Always a lot of police here, said Boris gloomily, sliding into the door as Gyuri took the turn hard.
For various reasons, I was apprehensive about accommodations and ready to make my excuses in case they involved anything like squatter conditions or sleeping on the floor. Luckily, Miriam had booked me a hotel in a canal house in the old part of town. I dropped my bags, locked the cash in the safe, and went back out to the street to meet Boris. Gyuri had gone to park the car. He dropped his cigarette on the cobblestones and dashed it under his heel.
I've not been here in a while, he said, his breath coming out white, looking round a bit appraisingly at the soberly clad pedestrians on the street. My flat in Antwerp. Well, it is for business reasons I am in Antwerp. Beautiful city, too. Same sea clouds, same light. Someday we will go there. But I always forget how much I like it here as well.
Starving to death, you?
He said, punching me in the arm.
Mind walking a bit?
Down narrow streets we wandered. Damp alleys too narrow for cars. Foggy little ochreous shops filled with old prints and dusty porcelains. Canal footbridge. Brown water. Lonely brown duck. Plastic cup half submerged and bobbing. The wind was raw and wet with blown pinpricks of sleet, and the space around us felt close and dank. Didn't the canals freeze in winter? I asked.
Yes, but,
wiping his nose,
global warming, I suppose.
In his overcoat and suit from the previous night's party, he looked both completely out of place and completely at home.
What a dog's weather. Shall we duck in here, do you think?
The dirty canal-side bar, or cafe, or whatever it was, had dark wood and a maritime theme. Oars and life preservers, red candles burning low even in the daytime, and a desolate, foggy feel. Smoky, muggy light. Water droplets condensed on the inside of the window pane. No menus. In back was a chalkboard scrawled with foods unintelligible to me.
Dachsoup, Dradsches Fles, Kapusenus Hotel, Zurkul Stampot. Here, let me order,
said Boris, and proceeded to do so, surprisingly, in Dutch. What arrived was a typically Boris meal of beer, bread, sausages, and potatoes with pork and sauerkraut. Boris, happily gobbling, was reminiscing about his first and only attempt to ride a bicycle in the city. Wipeout, disaster. And also how much he enjoyed the new herring in Amsterdam, which fortunately wasn't in season, since apparently you ate it by holding it up by the tail fin and dangling it down into your mouth. But I was too disoriented by my surroundings to listen very closely, and with almost painful heightened senses, I stirred at the potato mess with my fork and felt the strangeness of the city pressing in all around me. Smells of tobacco and malt and nutmeg. Cafe walls the melancholy brown of an old leather-bound book. And then beyond, dark passages and brackish water lapping, low skies and old buildings all leaning against each other with a moody, poetic, edge-of-destruction feel, the cobblestoned loneliness of a city that felt, to me anyway, like a place where you might come to let the water close over your head. Before long, Gyuri joined us, red-cheeked and breathless.
Parking. Bit of a problem here,
he said.
Sorry.
He extended his hand to me.
Glad to see you,
he said, embracing me with a genuine-seeming warmth that startled me, as if we were old friends long separated.
Everything is okay?
Boris, on his second pint by now, was holding forth a bit about Horst.
I do not know why he does not move to Amsterdam,
gnawing happily on a hunk of sausage.
Constantly he complains about New York. Hate, hate, hate. And all the holy while,
waving a hand at the canal outside the fogged window,
Everything he loves is here. Even the language is same as his. If he really wanted to be happy in the world, Horst, to have any kind of joyful or happy life, he should pay 20 grand to go back to his rapid detox place and then come here and smoke Buddha haze and stand in a museum all day long.
Horst? I said, looking between them.
Sorry?
Does he know you're here? Boris gulped his beer.
Horst? No, he does not.
It is going to be much, much easier if Horst learns about all this after. Because,
licking a dab of mustard off his finger,
my suspicions are correct. Fucking Sasha who stole the thing. Ulrika's brother, he said urgently. Which, with Ulrika, puts Horst in a bad position. So, much better if I take care of it on my own, see? I am doing Horst a favor this way. Favor he won't forget.
What do you mean, take care of it? Boris sighed. He looked around to make sure no one was listening, even though we were the only people in the place.
Well, it is complicated. I could talk for 3 days, but I can also tell you in 3 lines what has happened.
Does Ulrika know he took it? Rolled eyes.
Search me.
A phrase I had taught Boris years ago, horsing around at my house after school. Search me. Cut it out. Smoky desert twilight, shades drawn. Make up your mind. Let's face it. No way. Same shadows on his face. Gold light glinting off the doors by the pool.
I think Sasha would have to be very stupid to tell Ulrika,
said Gyuri with a worried expression on his face.
I don't know what Ulrika knows or does not know, has no relevance. She has loyalty to her brother over Horst, as she has shown many and many times over. You would think,
grandly signaling the waitress to bring Gyuri a pint,
you would think Sasha had sense to sit on it for a while, at least. But no. He can't get a loan on it in Hamburg or Frankfurt because of Horst. Because Horst would hear of it in 1 second. So he has brought it here.
Well, look, if you know who has it, we should just call the police. The silence and blank looks that followed this were as if I had produced a can of gasoline and suggested lighting ourselves on fire.
Well, I mean,
I said defensively, after the waitress had arrived with Gyuri's beer, set it down, left again, and neither Gyuri nor Boris had spoken a word.
Isn't that the safest? And easiest?
If the cops recover it and you have nothing to do with it? Ding of a bicycle bell. Woman clattering by on the sidewalk. Rattle of spokes. Witchy black cape flying behind.
Because,
glancing between them, when you think of what this picture has gone through, what it must have gone through, I don't know if you understand, Boris, how much care has to be taken even to ship a painting. Just to pack it properly? Why take any chances?
This is my feeling exactly.
An anonymous call to the art crimes people. They're not like the normal cops. No connections with the normal cops. The picture is all they care about. They'll know what to do. Boris leaned back in his chair. He looked around. Then he looked at me.
No,
he said.
That is not a good idea.
His tone was that of someone addressing a 5-year-old.
And do you want to know why?
Think about it. It's the easiest way. You wouldn't have to do a thing. Boris set his beer glass down carefully. They'd have the best chance of getting it back unharmed. Also, if I do it, if I call them, shit, I could have Hobie call them. Hands to head. Any way you look at it, you wouldn't be putting yourselves at risk. That is to say, I was too tired, disoriented. 2 pairs of Dremel drill eyes. I couldn't think. If I did it, or someone else not a part of your, organization. Boris let out a shout of laughter.
Organization? Well,
shaking his head so vigorously the hair fell in his eyes,
I suppose we count as organization of sorts, since we are 3 or more, but we are not very large or very organized, as you can see.
You should eat something,
said Gyuri to me, in the tense pause that followed, looking at my untouched plate of pork and potato.
He should eat,
he said to Boris.
Tell him to eat.
Let him starve if he wants. Anyway, said Boris, grabbing a chunk of pork off my plate and popping it in his mouth.
One call.
I'll do.